From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Seattle in 2014 when Seattle City Council voted to phase in a $15 minimum wage over the next several years. On the way to $15, Seattle has been stepping up the minimum, and many other cities are watching closely to try to understand the impact. Will it create more income equality? Will it result in more automation or lost jobs? This week, we learned a company in Farmington is raising its minimum wage to $15 from $10.50 an hour for starting employees at Pioneer Millworks. 65 employees in two cities, Farmington and Portland. Most of those employees here in the Rochester area. And Pioneer Millworks is not waiting for a state or federal minimum to go up. They're making that move on their own. This hour, a discussion about the minimum wage and how business owners of all sizes view it. And also what we're learning from Seattle so far. My guests in studio include Jonathan Orpin, the founder and president of Pioneer Millworks in Farmington. And Jonathan, you spend most of your time in Portland these days, is that right?
Yeah, I live in Portland right now.
But you're kind of back and forth still?
My heart's still here.
Your heart's there? You're a Rochester native?
Yeah, you betcha. McQuaid graduate.
Well, it's great to have you here.
And I'm here about every 4 weeks for a week.
Well, thank you for taking the time to come in. Tim Sheehan is the owner of Certified Automotive Repair in Bloomfield, a small business owner. And Tim, nice to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And on the phone is David Hyde. He's a reporter for KUOW in Seattle and has been kind of tracking what's been going on there. David, thanks for taking the time to join the program.
Hi, Evan. Thanks.
Before I jump to David, just for that kind of context and background at Seattle, I just want Jonathan to kind of tell us a little bit about the decision, and then as we go throughout the hour a little bit later, we'll go into it in more depth. But we're kind of keyed into this idea to have this discussion now because we heard from a local company that you're going to go ahead and make that move on your own now. Tell me about how many employees and how many people would be impacted by this.
Yeah, all told, our two companies have about 130 employees, New Energy Works Timber Framers and Pioneer Millworks. Pioneer Millworks represents about 65 of those. This program was announced as a minimum wage, internal minimum wage or a sustainable wage program, we're calling it, for the Pioneer Millworks part of the business. And we've been working on this for about a year, really seeing what the financial implications are, whether we think it's sustainable or not, how much it's going to cost us, honestly, and if we think we can sustain that. And so we believe we can. We believe it's a right decision. We believe it's a good business decision. And so we couldn't help but use Labor Day, surprise, surprise, as the time that we're actually announcing and beginning it. So the program officially starts on Monday.
And of the 65 employees at Pioneer Millworks, how many will be impacted by this?
About 26.
So a significant number.
A significant number, yeah. And anyone new who comes in, too, is going to be impacted, of course.
What do you estimate the annual cost to the company to be?
Between $150,000 and $200,000. But is that a cost or is that an investment? That's really what we're working on.
Okay, so a lot more to talk about with Jonathan as we go throughout the hour. Tim's got a smaller business, a couple employees in Bloomfield, and the minimum. If there were a minimum wage increase mandated, would it impact the people you employ, Tim?
It wouldn't impact anyone immediately, but I would offset my employees so that their rate was raised above that onset.
All right, so we've got two business owners in studio, and again, we're going to talk with them a lot more in depth here, but let me turn to David Hyde, who's joining us from KUOW in Seattle. And we go back to 2014. David, why don't you just remind our listeners what the schedule is, what the plan for Seattle is, and where things are now?
Yeah, so, the movement for this really started a little bit earlier, and this year, though, in April of 2015, this year, the law basically went up to $15 an hour for bigger businesses. So that's businesses with more than 500 employees, as well as chains. Like, so if you own a Subway franchise, you're now paying $15 an hour. And it's up to $13 an hour for the smaller businesses, and that's going to kick up to $15 in a few years.
There was, I think it's fair to say, some confusion when a University of Washington study came out a few months back, and I'll just read three headlines, and then you can kind of take me through some of what we are seeing about this, David. The Washington Post, a very credible new study on Seattle's $15 minimum wage has bad news for liberals. Kai Rizdahl in Marketplace did an interview with the man behind the study. That's Mark Long, professor of public policy at the University of Washington, and the headline in Marketplace was, a new study out of Seattle shows the downside of minimum wage increases. But on Fortune.com, the headline was, the Seattle minimum wage study is utter BS. So David, we're a little confused here. So why don't you tell us what we are, you know, what we're hearing out of UW, what some say the limitations might be, and what you think we can maybe learn so far.
This was a study that had originally been commissioned by the Seattle City Council when they passed the minimum wage law to try to track what was happening. And basically what the study found was that wages were up, right? That's the entire point of this, but that earnings were flat for low-wage workers, which is about the bottom 10% of workers here in Seattle. And that's because the total number of hours that employees were being given dropped, and that could have been due to a number of factors. It might have been simply the employer offered fewer hours, say, to newer employees. Maybe it was mechanization. Maybe they went out of business. But the total number of hours available to these employees dropped, and that meant their earnings were flat. And this is kind of weird, if this study is to be believed, because this is a period when, you know, the economy here is going completely crazy. Amazon's here. A lot of other companies are here. So earnings are up for low-wage workers in other cities outside of Seattle, and they're way up for the top 90% in the city of Seattle as well. So the irony, if you believe this study, is that the wage hike might not be helping the people that it was intended to help. But of course, there was also another study that came out about the same week.
We'll get to that in just a second here. Let me work through a little bit of what Kai Rizdahl talked with Mark Long about, and then we can kind of get more characterization from David. Mark Long told Marketplace, quote, "We were looking at what happened in Seattle when it raised its minimum wage from $9.47 an hour, which was the state's minimum wage, up to $13. What we found is that in exchange, hours were reduced by about 9%. As a result of that combination, we found that earnings were reduced for these low-wage jobs." And Rizdahl said, so employers, realizing that we're going to have to pay more per hour, cut people's hours. And Long responded, that's what it appears to be. That's one of the concerns we often hear from critics of this. But then you hear the critics of the study saying that's too sweeping, that there are limitations. Because Fortune, David, comes back and says that, you know, 40% of the jobs weren't even reviewed because they were, what, multi-location businesses? Or can tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's some pretty big data limitations in this University of Washington study, which the authors concede. It excluded multi-site businesses because the data that they were looking at didn't allow them to control for that. They did a survey to try to control for that as well. But the point is, there are data limitations in the study. That said, I mean, it's the Washington is one of four states that has this level of detail. So most studies that look at the minimum wage just look at, were jobs won, were jobs lost. But this one really zeroed in on low-wage workers in particular. So, you know, it depends on what you think and kind of what your politics are, it seems, in terms of how much you believe one study or the other. The other study that came out that week was by UC Berkeley authors.
Yeah. Is there any way that we're going to get data and not have it politicized? Because all I want to do is I just want to see what the data tells us in as distilled and sort of raw a form as possible. And of course, the UW study comes out and you've got headlines from people who didn't want to see the wage increase. They say, aha. But then the Berkeley study comes out and they say, nope, see, UW had flawed methodology. Is there any way we're going to see it not politicized?
I mean, I don't think here in Seattle this UW study is being taken terribly seriously. Hmm. You know, basically the minimum wage is settled law, and we're kind of moving forward on the minimum wage. You know, I think other places might look at this, and it might cause them to have some pause in terms of how quickly they want to raise the minimum wage. But I think overall, no, you're right. I mean, it's an age of growing partisanship, and you've got your facts, and I've got my facts. I mean, it seems like that's how things work.
Oh. I was hoping you would tell me something else. But David, I also want to read what Long said to Kai Rizdahl about takeaways from his study, because I did want to ask you, and you kind of just hinted at it there, that Seattle's not going back, at least not anytime soon. But what Long said when Rizdahl said, you know, well, really, what can we learn from this? Long said, quote, I think there's two things you should take away from this. One is there should be some concern about the disemployment effects, particularly if local minimum wages, in particular when it's a large increase in the minimum minimum wage. Disemployment effects are reduction in the job opportunities, the jobs and the hours available. But the other thing you should be thinking about is what are the distributional effects? And that's one of the things we plan to study. So, for example, is this causing a reduction in opportunities for teenagers while at the same time promoting the opportunities for low-wage heads of households? And if that is the case, it may be worth it. The trade-off between promoting the living wage opportunities for working adults who have children in exchange for reduction in teenage job opportunities. Do you get the sense, David, that Seattle City Council at least is hearing that but saying, look, far too early. We're not scrapping this. Long can say what he wants. We'll keep tracking it, but we're not going to sit here and say that we've seen enough that tells us this is not going to help the population we want to help.
You know, this, what I've heard from the Seattle City Council is that $15 is not enough to live in Seattle, and that the people that are earning $15 now and that are getting the hours that they want, that they're doing much better. That said, I mean, there's a lot of other things that the city of Seattle is doing to try to help this class of low-wage workers, looking more on the cost side. I mean, affordable housing is a huge issue right now here, as it is probably a lot of places. They're also, we have one of the more regressive tax systems in the country, so the city's trying to implement a city income tax, although that comes up against state law that prohibits any city, including the state of Washington, actually, from having an income tax. So that's really more the direction things are happening here.
I think that's important to point out because that's where, David, it would be not apples to apples. If Rochester or any other city wanted to look at Seattle, don't you have to take into account everything that a local government is trying to do to address income inequality, equal opportunity, et cetera? It sounds like Seattle is at least looking more broadly speaking as opposed to just on the wage side, yes?
Yeah, well, I think it's the minimum wage plus here. I mean, we're kind of the Berkeley to the north at this point. Other places are a little bit different politically, but, you know, it's a pretty affluent city and it's a pretty left-wing city right now.
And so finally, you know, you say city council really isn't going back on this anytime soon, and they will continue to study it. But what do you hear from the business community? That is a broad question, and in some ways it's a little unfair because small business owners might say something different. You know, somebody at Amazon may say something different than somebody who owns a Subway restaurant. But generally speaking, is there a way that you can characterize what the business community is saying?
You know, small businesses have different perspectives on this. I mentioned earlier, if you're a small business with fewer than 500 employees, you're up to $13 an hour now. And for a lot of businesses, business is pretty good right now, right? There's a lot of people. There's 56 people moving here a day. Many of them are Amazon workers with big paychecks. And so if you've got a bar or restaurant, you know, that's catering to that group of workers, you're probably doing pretty well, and you can raise prices to offset your increased costs as a result of this minimum wage increase. Other businesses are, other restaurants are basically building mandatory tips in. That was kind of an issue in the restaurant industry, was whether or not they would get a tip credit. So they're going that route. But I would say the group of franchise owners, the Subway owners, they're struggling because they're considered a part of this larger business class. And at least the ones that I've talked to say it's tough to sell $3.50 sandwiches and have the staff that they need at the $15 an hour minimum wage and kind of stay in business. So it's a little bit depends on who you are.
Okay, and so finally, that's a great point. Sometimes we overgeneralize on everything, and minimum wage being a perfect example. So what is the, David, for you, is there a warning to the public to try not to oversimplify this issue? I mean, do we have to accept that it's going to be complex and that it's going to take time to really absorb what's going on there?
Yes, that sounds about right to me. Having tried to understand both of these studies as well as I possibly can, I would say that's a fair characterization. But, you know, it would be great if politicians and the public and everybody else could kind of keep an open mind and try to look at these studies, carefully and sort of rationally and try to create the best governance and policy based on the information that they're getting. That's what I'd like to see happen.
David Hyde is a reporter for KUOW in Seattle, generous with his time for us this morning. We will continue to check in with you and your colleagues with the great work you're doing out there at KUOW. David, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Evan.
Very interesting stuff out of Seattle. So let's turn back in studio as we talk minimum wage. We've got Jonathan Orpin, the founder and president of Pioneer Millworks. That's in Farmington and Portland. He's a Rochester native who now splits his time, spends most of his time in Portland. Tim Schieffen, owner of Certified Automotive Repair in Bloomfield, New York. So a couple of people on the management side in business, different size companies. And Jonathan, especially being out there in Portland, you know, you're close to Seattle. How closely are you watching what's going on in Seattle?
Oh, yeah, really closely. And Portland is, of course, affected by Seattle. We're their little brother, as they like to call us often enough. But, you know, one of the things he pointed out was the smaller that subway, for instance, is struggling. The other side of that story, though, is less than 15, he might not be able to find anybody or find anybody who can really show up. It's a very competitive market out there. In Yamhill County, where our production facility is right outside of Portland, for instance, it's 3.2% unemployment. All the hand-wringing about, you know, not being able to pay the person, the other side of that is that you won't be able to find the person.
To work for less than 15.
Exactly. So, you know, it's the two go hand in hand out there. It is a different story here, and we're in Rochester, so we should talk about Rochester. But, you know, out there, that's a really different world right now.
Okay.
To buy a house out there that you can buy for $150,000 here is a $350,000 house. And it's a tricky deal. So I'm not too worried about Portland or Seattle right now. Rochester's a different story.
Okay. Tim, what do you make of that, what we're seeing out there so far?
Well, I don't have enough information to really make a good decision on the subway guy. Here in New York, my understanding is if you have a franchise and that franchise has more than a certain number of locations, you're mandated to pay a higher rate right out of the gate than everybody else. But that franchise is still owned by a single proprietor. It's still a small business. Sure, there's 75 subways in the region, but this single owner, single sale subway location has still got the same problems that I do. I'm the small of the small. You know, I have two full-time, two part-time. So I'm not grasping big numbers, huge dollars, giant changes. My changes are subtle. But I agree that it's going to be extremely difficult to find these entry-level people, even at this slowly graduated change in the minimum wage. And that's who's going to be left behind. It's going to be the younger people, the people without skills. And that's whose job has been eliminated at my company. I don't have an entry-level job anymore because I'm not going to pay a high school kid over the summer with no skills this higher rate.
You used to?
I used to, yep. Every summer I'd have a high school kid in there, 16 to 17-year-old young man. He may be doing menial tasks, cleaning up. He might be learning a little. He might be helping the auto mechanics. He might be running errands. And I always had a position. I always found the position easy to fill. Maybe the candidate didn't turn out as well as I'd like, but I always had numerous candidates to choose from. And I won't subject myself to that inexperience, the mistakes, that learning curve at the higher rate. I just won't do it.
Let's just put this in context. We're talking about $10.25 in your case.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. So for you, Tim, right now, you feel already impacted because you are making a hiring decision, or at least a temporary employment decision, a seasonal employment decision, based on the wage now as is.
That's correct. It's going to be better for me and better for my machine to have a more experienced person, have a more trustworthy person, and pay them more per hour. That's just something I'm going to embrace due to that increase.
Now, Jonathan, let's work through what you said earlier, which is that, you know, your estimate for your company, 26 out of your 65 employees will be impacted by your company's decision to raise its minimum to $15. That's a significant portion, and that's $150,000 to $200,000 a year. But you said you think it is not only the right thing to do, but a good business decision. So tell me about why you feel that way.
Sure. The comment of getting the right people is key. I mean, that really is the key. I can't solve all the world's problems, and I'm not smart enough to understand them all. But I do know that I enjoy working with people who are strong coworkers of mine. And we want that. We need that. So for us, it's an investment. In the same way we might invest the same amount of money in a new piece of equipment, we think, wow, why don't we invest it in our people? And so that's what we see. We're investing in our people and requiring and probably easily finding a stronger group of people, potentially. A person comes in at 10:25, comes in maybe late, not as strong a candidate as we can, maybe isn't feeling well, isn't a great performer. Well, it's 10:25 an hour. We understand that maybe there's some flexibility there, or as you said, Tim, you know, he's maybe not your best candidate. At 15, we expect and we can require a higher performance level. So for us, it's an investment. It's a business decision as well as an economic philosophy on our part. I'm tired of looking at my people and wondering if they can eat or if they are worried about being able to repair the alternator in their car or make the health insurance that they need to pay in their copay. It's exhausting. I really want people in my company to be able to have a sustainable wage. And we've made that commitment both for business decisions, but also philosophical decisions. And I'm good with that.
When did you announce it to your company that you were making this change?
All week long, we've had a series of small meetings. Again, we're kind of big for getting everybody together, though we do that on occasion. In this case, I wanted a more intimate conversation with the various groups. So we have had six meetings of smaller groups all week long, and I've got then two more on the West Coast on Tuesday.
And what's been the reaction among your employees?
So I would say it's jaw-dropping.
Really?
Would you be surprised?
Well... I guess not. I mean, we're talking about almost half your workforce being impacted.
Yeah, and it's not just impacting because, oh gosh, now I can buy another toy. This is impacting because now my family can live a better life. Now I can actually consider having a family. And there's also a little concern, too, because we've got, for some, everyone will be going through a review now, everyone who's not already at the $15, and we do have plenty more than that, but the ones who are impacted will now go through a review. Some will get automatic, others will be given 90 days to step up, and we hope to do that through training and clear communication. Sadly, those against minimum wage always talk about those left behind. There will be some left behind. I can't solve all the world's problems, but I can demand a higher performance level for a higher wage. We are what we call a work well, pay well company, and that's what our goal is.
When you say left behind, I assume what you mean is some people will not make the review and be deemed, you know,
unemployed.
I think
the word you're looking for is unemployed.
But you're not going to leave those jobs unfilled. You'll fill them with someone else.
Yeah, that's the expectation.
Okay, so
yeah,
you're not going to cut workforce and raise wages. You're going to keep the workforce the same level.
Yeah, there's no cutting workforce plans here. In fact, if anything, we expect it to grow because we'll be yet a better company. And every time we do one of these crazy things that we tend to do, we grow. You know, we bought some expensive equipment where other people are like, oh, automation's coming in. Well, no, actually, we grew when we bought that expensive equipment because our market grew and our capacity grew. So I think good business relies on good investment. We consider this a good investment. I do want to say one more thing, though. Just because we will be surprised if we get 100% retainage after the 90%, we'll also be joyful. So there's no preconception here.
Okay. And let me ask both of you, what we often hear from those who are concerned about raising the wage to $15 is that, well, let's say your wage at Pioneer Mill Works, for example, $10.50 is your minimum, and you've got some people at $10.50 and some between $10.50 and $15.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fair. So the argument kind of sounds something like this. I'm trying to approximate. Well, you know, Jonathan, you've got some people at $10.50, you've got some people at $12.50, you've got some people at $14. But what about the person who's at $15 now? Do you also raise his wage? And what does it say to him if everyone now is making the same? Does he feel devalued?
Gotcha.
Or he or she, by the way.
Yeah. Evan, you're like a plant with all these good questions. Oh, but this is what you do, right?
So, well, I I've heard that argument many times, and I just want to encounter it in the wild, so to speak.
In the wild is right.
Yeah.
By the way, small business is the wild. Well, here's our attitude. We're thankful to be able to do this. We expect the person at $15.50 who's taken 3 years to get there to have pause. But we also, on reflection, we expect that person to celebrate for his coworker or her coworker. We, for the person who really feels like, oh gosh, where were you 2 years ago? We can only say, we wish we were there 2 years ago, but isn't it exciting we're here now? For the person who can't get over that, we expect them to move on, and we'll help them do that.
Okay, fair enough.
It's a zero. It's a zero tolerance policy, frankly, for whiners.
Okay, but you're not going to raise someone's wage at $15.50 to $17 or something.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. We will if they deserve it and we can afford it. This right now is simply a policy of sustainable living, which you cannot do at $10.25 an hour.
Listeners, you're hearing Jonathan Orpin, the founder and president of Pioneer Millworks in Farmington and Portland. He's a Rochester native, and the company there are telling employees this week that they're going to a $15 minimum wage of their own decision. That affects almost half the workforce, and you're hearing why they're doing it. If you want to join the program with phone calls or comments, questions, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Tim Schieffen is the owner of Certified Automotive Repair in Bloomfield, New York. And, you know, Tim, do you have a different view? Do you have a feeling that employees, if you bump up the people, quote-unquote, at the bottom, that others... That resentment, you know, Jonathan's saying we don't have any patience for that. Essentially, you have to get over that. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm the small of the small. So while I admire Jonathan and his eagerness to grow his business and to capitalize on the attributes of what he's seeing come his way, I think it's noble and I think it's great for a number of his employees. Wouldn't work for me. I've got two skilled employees. So if I lose those two skilled employees, the job, the people out there in the job market are not going to come rushing to fill those positions. It just doesn't happen. We don't find the skilled employees. Now, these skilled employees, when that minimum wage increase creeps up onto their current rate per hour, I'm going to have to meter that up. I'm going to have to keep these guys happy because they deserve it. Because I, too, would like to see them have a decent paycheck and be able to afford the finer things in life. But let's talk about both of our businesses for a quick second. I think it's easy for me to presume that Jonathan's business is not hiring a single mom who's trying to feed her family and pay her rent and pay a cell phone bill, and she has no skills. She's probably not going to come and apply for one of the jobs he's going to have open at the $15 an hour. And Jonathan, chime in if I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
How about the high school kid?
I've got plenty exactly as you describe.
How about the high school kid coming out of 12th grade and he's looking for a part-time job over the summer?
Yeah, the part-time actually, this is only for full-time people. Mm-hmm. So there is some flexibility in that part of it. So for a part-time person, but I want to really go back to that mom. This program is designed for her. And we have her. Her name's Pam, or her name is Judy, or her name... We've got her. You want to come meet her? Come meet her.
No, that's great.
Interestingly, we have a series of... Our Christmas parties are kind of interesting. We have advanced degrees engineers standing next to folks who, frankly, just got out of jail and are catching boards at the end of the mill workshop. We've got everybody involved in that place. And so the unskilled, though hardworking person... also deserves a sustainable wage in the same way that the skilled person, who's also hardworking, should be able to earn more.
Well, I think, again, that's admirable. And
good business.
And I can see where it is good business. Let me get a little bit further out of that box. If this is the solution to narrow the distance between the lower wage classes and the upper wage classes, It's gonna knock a lot of small businesses out on the pathway, and it's gonna, in my opinion, it's going to cause for a larger amount of unemployed youth, a larger amount of unemployed unskilled people who maybe don't have the ability to educate quickly and easily, or get up to speed with the skills required for the jobs that are available at these better rates. So I think it's a calloused look by some as a solution that really hasn't been proven yet. And earlier, Evan cited a number of articles in a number of publications and from a number of studies. A lot of these articles I reviewed last night, most of them are done by very intelligent people that are employed by universities whose business it is to climb inside these and analyze and see what the results are. And there was a mixed response. But the majority of those responses cited the same things I just pointed out. There's a larger segment of our youth that are unemployed. There's a larger segment of these unskilled people at these current lower wages that aren't going to be able to compete in the marketplace. So, you know, you got a narrower gap for these people to process through to find employment. You had Brian Kolb here on the radio here mm-hmm. a couple months ago, and he nailed it. The minimum wage was never intended to be a living wage. That's why it's not called a living wage. It's called a minimum wage. The minimum wage is intended for entry level, high school kids, part-time people who are looking to make a little extra bucks here and there, people without skills that don't want to go and get re-educated because this isn't a career. Maybe it's a short-term employment stint for them. And we're going to need that, and we're going to need that perpetual. Living wages used to be broadcast by places like municipalities and governments. You know, we need to pay our employees living wage. We need to pay our employees living wage. Big box employers, the Xeroxes, the Kodaks of Rochester, you know, they paid a decent wage. You know, they certainly fathered this American dream in the middle class. We need this variety through these classes, and there's a reason there's a division. When we start bumping these minimum wages up so high, the richer are going to get more rich. The machine's going to work to the advantage of the masses. These people with huge employment and workforces, they're going to just amp up their prices. They're going to amp up their products' costs to the consumers. It's going to be a trade-off. So there's no penalty to the upper 1%. The penalty is to those that are trying to survive at the low end of the scale. Things don't go down.
Let me just say, if you're on the phone, we're about to get our only break of the hour. We're going to get your phone calls. A lot of people want to weigh in, but I suspect Jonathan wants to weigh in. I wanted to ask you if you agree with Tim that the minimum wage was never meant to be a living wage.
I totally agree. Unfortunately, it's being used that way over and over again. And when we say minimum wage, we're also talking about generally the lower wage that we've seen over the last 20 to 30 years. Wages have stagnated tremendously when, after World War II, we were a strong economy because there was a middle class, because people could buy a house. Right now, that's not there anymore. If the minimum wage had just kept pace with the basic dollar, it would be $21 right now. $21. So the attack on the working class has been systemic and consistent, and it continues today. And that's really what the problem is. But I do want to say, I'm not really here to judge other industries. I don't really know much about farm workers. I can't run a restaurant. So I am really just talking about Pioneer Millworks. I'm really talking about what I think is the right thing to do here. So it is a complex situation, and I think a good law can take into consideration variation. For instance, there may be exclusions for farm workers. There may be exclusions for that teenage part-time person. I don't have a problem with that. I just have a problem with the continued attack on the general working class that has occurred in the last 20 to 30 years.
So does that mean, Jonathan, that you view, well, would you still leave it up to business owners like yourself to make this decision, or do you want to see more government policy bringing that wage up?
I believe that a good partnership with business and government is the only solution. Business is the most powerful opportunity for social change and betterment. Unfortunately, it's not happening right now, and this is so critical to understand. Peter Drucker, the most amazing business thinker in the last century, said, past a 20-to-1 ratio between the earnings of the top CEO and his people is bad for business and bad for morale. Right now, we're at somewhere between 200 and 350 times the top CEO's payments, earnings over their median earned worker. 350 times. That's what's bad for America. That's what's failing here.
So why don't we work on bringing that down?
You betcha, buddy. We'll do that too. Or both. You know, it's all the same in the end.
I think bringing that down would help more than bringing the bottom up and excluding all these poor people who are trying to survive there now.
All right, well, let's get our only break of the hour, and let's see what our listeners have to say. Really interesting conversation among our guests. You heard David Hyde earlier this hour, a reporter with KUOW in Seattle. You just heard Jonathan Orpin, founder and president of Pioneer Millworks in Farmington and Portland. 55 employees here in the Rochester area, 10 more in Portland. Jonathan splits his time, but he's a Rochester native. Tim Sheefin, the owner of Certified Automotive Repair in Bloomfield, New York, small business owner with 2 full-time, 2 part-time employees. Let's get your phone calls after this break on Connect. Coming up in our second hour, the remarkable story of a local church celebrating 190 years, a church with the kind of history that we all should know about. A former shelter on the Underground Railroad for people who escaped slavery, led by Harriet Tubman. The place where Susan B. Anthony delivered her final public address. The home church of Frederick Douglass, the place where Douglass edited his abolitionist paper. They've got big plans coming up, and we'll go through the history as well next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. As I jump to your phone calls, I see the phone still ringing. Tim Sheefin, remind our listeners what it is that your business is in Bloomfield.
We are a full-service auto mechanic repair shop.
and it's certified automotive repair in Bloomfield. Jonathan Orpin, Pioneer Millworks is what?
We reclaim old buildings and wood of all sorts and turn it into new things like flooring and paneling and cabinets and timber frames and all sorts of things.
No shortage of work for either of you guys, I assume, right now.
We're strong.
As can be.
Yeah. Let's get to your phone calls, and I'm going to start with Matt in Geneva. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, my question is, I actually worked for one of these companies quite a few years ago, and I appreciate the philosophical thought behind giving people a living wage to keep morale up at a company. My question is, how have work conditions changed in regards to requiring people to work 8 hours overtime but be paid straight time so they could take a Saturday off, that minimum wage class being referred to out loud during company meetings as nail monkeys, requiring people to drive 10 hours round trip to a job site but only being paid for 5 hours of that travel time.
All right, thanks for the phone call, Matt.
Hey, Matt, how you doing? You know, it seems like a long time ago since we've talked. I'm not really sure all the things you're referring to, but, you know, we follow the law, and I think we're a good place to work. But rock on, dude.
Okay. So generally speaking, can you characterize the questions he's having? Again, I don't want to get into sort of allegations that go back years.
Yeah, it's silly.
But how much flexibility should a company have to say, hey, if you want an extra day off, you know, give us a few extra hours here and there. And you know, how do you work with that? You say, obviously, you stay within the law for that.
Yeah, we just stay within the law.
Okay.
It's against the law to bank hours.
Yeah.
So we can't offer that. But if you ask my employees, I'm pretty sure they'll tell you I'm as flexible as they come as long as I have notice. You know, if my guy says, hey, can I take next Thursday off? That's not a problem. If a guy comes in and says, look, I'd really like to take tomorrow off, well, I got appointments. I got a schedule to keep, so I might not be that flexible. But I ask my employees, work 40 hours and stop. I don't want you to work more than 40 hours. Come in at 8, go home at 5. That's my goal, to get them out the door when they expect to. It's my goal to give them the lunchtime they deserve and they desire and they've earned. So I do my best to, A, be legal, and B, be flexible.
Okay. Jonathan, thoughts on that?
Yeah, we're all about overtime. It helps people make pay if they want it, and yeah.
Okay. Ray writes from Rochester and says, cheers, Jonathan. An employer speaking on investing in people. The status quo needs updating. The economy will have to change. It's going to cause sacrifices for many, keeping pace in the machine of our unrelenting capitalist culture, especially those business owners most affected by systemic racism. However, as a society, goals of sustainable living are paramount in resolving income inequality, and many in privilege need to step up and collectively be part of this hard but needed sacrifice in their previously sought business paths. That's Ray from Rochester saluting Jonathan. Do you agree with his characterization?
Yes.
Okay. Tim?
Yeah, I mean, it's not bad, but I would add, you want a sustainable wage? You want to earn more? Be worth more. Get educated. Learn a skill. Work hard. Show up every day on time. You know, you'll earn a raise at
Tim,
my shop.
We agree with that. You betcha, bud.
If you have merit, you may get a raise. If you're showing up, you're doing what I expect, I'm likely to give you a raise. Don't ask me for a raise a day after you've been late. Don't ask me for a raise after you've ruined or broke something.
Pam writes to us and says, I'm writing because I am one of the employees that has been recently raised to Jonathan's sustainable living wage, and I want to tell you that I am a single mom. I'm 43. I've been in the restaurant business and airline industry for the past 20-plus years. This is the first company that treats its employees like human beings. It's not just about money. It's about people. And that is from Pam. I think you mentioned Pam earlier.
She came to my mind.
All right.
By name.
Is that gratifying as a business owner to hear that kind of response?
We've had six meetings with people, small, intimate meetings. I looked from eyeball to eyeball. At the end, somebody said to me, how do you feel? And I said, wow, this was magnificent. So, yeah, I mean, from a gratification standpoint, it rocks.
All right, let's get back to your phone calls. Andrew in Rochester. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hello, I've just been enjoying the program about minimum wage. I think that John is making an awesome point. And I think it proves, almost beyond a shadow of a doubt, that you don't need the government to dictate minimum wage. Let the CEOs decide. They know the best. He knows if he wants to have a good company, he's going to offer $15 an hour. He's got to invest in people. Pam just wrote and you said, and she said, feel like a person. If you're getting a raise, then you're getting a check because the boss likes you. You're going to work harder. Government says dictate how people should get paid. You don't feel important. You feel like I need someone to help me. It's tremendous. I wish everyone would do that. Listen what you hear what your people are saying. Tim also said the same thing. A merit society. They get a raise because they're good work. Everybody's going to want to try to do better to get that raise without the government getting involved. The government should stay out of minimum wage. I really feel that way.
All right, Andrew, thanks for the phone call. I'll ask you both to respond. He mentioned you first, Jonathan. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I basically agree. As I said earlier, I think business is the most powerful tool and opportunity we have for social change. Unfortunately, we're not really seeing enough of that. And I mentioned the reasons why. So I think a careful balance and partnership between thoughtful regulation and a strong, better, healthier business attitude, one that minimizes the greed we see and thinks about future generations as opposed to the next quarter's profit, I think it all works together.
Okay. Tim?
I would just say to your caller, I love you. I wish there were more citizens out there like you that had the attitude that you have. Something that came to mind while he was talking, I guess we'll move on because it's now
it came
out of my
right
mind.
Out of your mind. That's right. It'll come back. And that happens to me all the time when you do 500 hours of live radio a year. Let's get Bruce and Irondequoit next on the phone. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah. His mention that it was never intended to be a living wage. What it was intended is not really the point. It's what we need now. And why was there ever a need for minimum wage? Well, because businesses take advantage of people. They're not human beings. Even though humans are making the decision, they hide behind the oh, we're just doing business. So why did we ever need one if businesses always just did the right thing? So we don't have to worry about what the laws were before, just like we didn't have to worry about what the Constitution said before when they thought a black person was three-fifths of a human being. What we need is action now. Our stagnation of wages is driving this country down. We need, and if we need the social vote, if we like to be like our grandfathers, we get on the street.
Hey, Bruce, let me just jump in because I'm losing your phone call there. It's breaking up. But I think I'd like to ask our guests each a question based on your phone call. I'll start with Jonathan because what Bruce is saying is we need action now. And Jonathan has said that in many ways you think business is a great tool for social change, but you've said unfortunately we're not seeing enough of it, which is why it sounds to me, and I don't want to mischaracterize your feelings on this, if government were to compel businesses to do that more often, it might be more understandable just given the fact that your colleagues across industries aren't doing it as much as maybe you would like. I don't know if is that fair?
Sure. It's a balance.
Okay.
I mean, I think that Bruce is right that things aren't working as they're supposed to and that citizens actually have to be protected from greed. And often we see that in businesses and have seen that forever. So, yeah. But on the same token, I'm willing to do it now.
Okay, and so what I wanted to ask you was, do you expect that with more conversations publicly like this, leading by example, can other companies see what Pioneer Millworks is doing? Are there going to be, is that part of the goal of this, to be part of that societal conversation, or is it you're doing it because it works for your company? I mean, do you want to lead by example? Do you want to inspire others to do what you're doing?
No, sure. I think, isn't that always part of us? We always want to be leaders and we always want to help to people see your own view. I don't know. I feel uncomfortable being put in that position. This is about Pioneer Millworks. And if others see it as a valid opportunity and opportunity for change and betterment of their own company, well, then good for them.
Okay. And Tim, what he said was, it doesn't really matter if the minimum wage was not designed as a living wage. What matters is what is the situation now. Do you agree or disagree with that?
50-50. My point came back into my head, and it's right up Bruce's alley. You've got two unique examples sitting here in the room, Jonathan and Tim. And it sounds like Jonathan is passionate about his business. He sounds like he's got his head screwed on tight. And it sounds like Jonathan doesn't show up to his work in a $300,000 Lamborghini and show it off to the employees. I don't have a $300,000 Lamborghini. I got a crappy old Ford pickup truck. So I'm not looking to be rich. I'm not greedy and got to live in a multi-million dollar home. I'm not taking lavish vacations. I wear dirty clothes to work. I get dirty at work. I work along with my guys. I wouldn't ask them to do anything I wouldn't do myself. And at the end of the day, we make a little money and I have a comfortable lifestyle and I live very meagerly. Now, The minimum wage is because there's so many business owners that do not follow that type of methodology. So you've got a lot of greed out there. You've got a lot of business owners that all they want is the almighty dollar, and they want the vacations and the Lamborghinis. And because of that, we've got CEOs that make way, 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 way more than the main body of the employees in their organization. I've often thought if the company is a publicly traded company, there ought to be limitations to the CEO's pay. If the company is a privately owned company, a family owned company, and I'll give a perfect example, Ford Motor Company, they're going to defend that company and they're going to make sure that company is not dead. Who'd kill the cash cow? They're going to keep the business running. They're going to put their mind at work to keep the business viable. And that's why I chose that example. They have been viable. They didn't get a bailout. They're a global company, and I would bet they treat their employees pretty well. And yeah, sure, the owners are probably rich and making big money, but look at the business.
On the other side of that token, we can use Walmart as an example, where many, many, many people in Walmart are well below the poverty wage and are held down by not being able to be given enough hours. And this has happened long before any of this arguments about minimum wage. And yet on the top 10 richest people in America, we have the whole Walmart family. Exactly. There's nothing right about that. There's nothing right about that.
Let me read an email from a listener named Mary who says, although I'm happy that Jonathan supports increasing the minimum wage, I'm no whiner. Through training and experience, I've worked my way up to 15. Now a newbie with no training or experience gets the same as me? Your answer to move on is insulting.
Right on, and it was probably a bit extreme. I accept Mary's rebuke.
Okay, but the policy is going to still be the same, though.
You know, no, it isn't. What we said to people in a more intimate setting was, come talk to us. We get it. Come talk to your supervisor. And if there is more money available, if you've earned it, if your skills put you above the next person, then we need to talk.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just logic. It's just person to person.
Love you, Mary.
Keith in Farmington. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting show, but and please hear me out on this. I think you guys should quit using the term unskilled workforce because, first of all, I mean, would you, in your mind, who's unskilled? A waitress, a janitor, the guy who takes care of your lawn? Because I'm old enough to know a lot of people who are highly educated but could not mop a floor to save their life. But yet, the guy who's highly educated, and let's say he's a professor, he's considered skilled. But the guy mopping the floor is always called or always referred to as the unskilled. Why don't we just eliminate that phrase and just say less educated people, because usually the more educated you are, the higher your income. I just take it, and I have a horse in this race because my job is big time classified as unskilled. But if I don't do it well, guess what? I don't have a job.
Okay, well, Keith,
I don't have customers and I don't have employees.
All right, Keith, thanks for the phone call. Jonathan?
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. That's actually the approach we're taking. Pioneer Millworks particularly has that classic sort of unskilled opportunities, as well as more skilled or educated or less educated. You know, we have a lot of jobs that are just really rough. They're just manual labor jobs. And traditionally, those have been held down. And traditionally, we haven't been able to pay as much. So that's one of the reasons why we, too, agree with you that it's not about whether you're skilled or not. It's whether you're valuable and whether you've working hard.
Okay. Tim?
I would second that, and I would add, you know, it's not nice for me to use words that are derogatory. So maybe I should use a multiple of words when I describe some of the people I wouldn't hire. Untrainable. Can't figure it out after a few days. Unable to comprehend simple instructions. You might be skilled, but you might be savvy or bright or have some common sense. I could use somebody with common sense, and I can train somebody with common sense. But if you're ignorant or have a learning disability, maybe I'm not the guy you should apply for a job at.
All right, Jonathan, I want to ask you as we get ready to close the program this hour. If you're just joining us or if you missed part of the conversation, Jonathan Orpin is the founder and president of Pioneer Millworks in Farmington, and we reached out to have this program today because their company is moving to a $15 minimum wage on their own. 26 of the 65 employees are going to be impacted by that decision, and it's going to cost the company $150,000 to $200,000 annually, though Jonathan says not necessarily a cost. They view that as an investment. Let me ask you just what you expect with turnover. What is your average turnover, and do you think that will change with this?
I don't have a number for an average turnover, but Pioneer, I would give it the word unacceptable. We have a reasonably high turnover at Pioneer Millworks, mostly given the difficulty of the work, but also, I think, because we don't pay enough. And so we're expecting it to cut down to really low.
Which is obviously a benefit there. Tim, is that one of the possible benefits when wages go up, that all of a sudden you don't have to spend time training, that you've got more experience, you've got people, you're smiling?
I'm smiling because, you know, in a perfect world, I'm going to have 10 perfect candidates call me after this radio show, but I don't think I'll have one. So, no, you know, in my business, it's too tough to get properly trained people at an affordable rate for me. And if I pay them what they may truly deserve, my prices will go up so high, I'm sure it'll affect my bottom line.
We could have just read emails and feedback all hour long. I've got people who want to work for both of you guys. I'm not sure there's any jobs open. But I just want to thank our guests. We had a conversation on the minimum wage this hour. Tim Sheafin, owner of Certified Automotive Repair in Bloomfield. Nice having you here, Tim. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Jonathan Orpin, founder and president of Pioneer Millworks in Farmington, New York, Rochester native. Nice to have you in studio here and hope to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right, very good. Our thanks to David Hyde as well from KUOW in Seattle. Short break, more connections coming up.